Jim, what is the Alberta Biodiversity Monitoring Institute?
Well, we often refer to ourselves as the ABMI, so the Alberta Biodiversity Monitoring Institute's a mouthful. ABMI, for short, is a system for monitoring the health of Alberta's wildlife, Alberta's nature, Alberta's ecosystems across the province. And it's a world-class scientific program that puts people in the field, boots on the ground, to measure the health of Alberta's species and ecosystems.
Why is it necessary to have this?
In a nutshell, you manage what you measure. And at the scale that many of the new policies in Alberta are operating, the land use framework, the energy strategy, for example, certainly heightened interest across the province in cumulative effects assessment and the management of a cumulative footprint in Alberta, we traditionally have very little in terms of knowledge that operates at that scale. So the being able to report on the health of Alberta's regions, parklands, prairies, municipalities even, certainly the new land use framework regions. The ABMI, our program, fills a gap in terms of gathering that information, packaging that information, and making sure that it's available to every Albertan.
Now, it's taken a long time to get this program up and running. Can you tell me a little bit about the beginning, the history? What is it that you had to go through in the beginning to really get people to accept this idea of doing this type of biodiversity monitoring?
It certainly has. We've been at this for quite a while. In 1997 and 1998, there was a vision from a small group of scientists and managers in the government of Alberta and some of the resource managers in the forest industry to collectively come together and harmonize how they collect data or information on wildlife. At that time, it was all about collecting that information consistently across the forested part of the province. So we had a whole bunch of FMAs. There was a lot of pressure at that time on sustainable forest management, and still is today. But the response was, well, if we're going to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars, can we do it collectively on an industry-wide basis, do it in a consistent way, and do it in a scientifically credible way? So a number of scientists, well over 40 of Alberta's resource scientists, were involved in developing a system of protocols that made sure that we looked at scientifically credible ways that we could roll out a program that looks at things like birds, breeding birds, mammals, dead wood, live trees, soil conditions, across the forested part of the province. That went really well. I think there was good consensus within much of the scientific community that this kind of program would be worthwhile to move ahead in. And in about 2003, after that 4 years worth of development, there was an odd thing happened. So the scientists realized at that time that they had a great scientific program, a great scientific foundation, another great idea coming out of essentially academia, and they said, but we can't make this happen on our own. Something that doesn't happen very often in the scientific community. They looked for help externally. So they looked for leadership in senior government folks, industry, and got some people involved who knew how to make a program operational. So in 2003, a management board was struck. The management board had 16 senior representatives from Alberta Agriculture, Alberta Environment, Alberta Ministry of Sustainable Resource Development, the energy sector, the forestry sector, and importantly, the environmental community. So all of those folks came to the table, had a common vision in what they wanted to see, and understood the business of making these kind of programs, large-scale programs, operational. So we had went into a prototype or a proof of concept phase under the leadership of, I guess, thankfully, not academics and researchers, and came out on the other side of that with a very successful model. So the idea was we put people into the field to prove that this could be done, that it was going to be scientifically robust, so never losing sight of the vision of a scientifically credible program, but making sure that it actually had relevance to Albertans, to Alberta policy development and to management. So in 2006, that board was dissolved, and we struck a not-for-profit or registered not-for-profit organization and moved into our operational phase. Our operational phase, again, has a, we are a standalone not-for-profit organization, and we're under the leadership of the same kinds of organizations that helped us through the prototype phase.
Takes a lot of money to make this work. Who are your sponsors and what's your budget like?
So we've enjoyed great and tremendous support from the forest industry, energy industry, and the Government of Alberta. Government of Canada has also been a strong supporter for a number of years. It's a $12 million per year project. We are designed to run in perpetuity. So it takes a fairly significant commitment to make this program happen and generate the kind of results that are needed to make informed decisions about environmental sustainability in Alberta. Currently we operate, so that is in 2008, we've operated on a $4.5 million budget.
So what are you going to do to get up to full capacity budget-wise?
We have a lot of work ahead of us. We still see tremendous opportunity, and we have great support from our energy partners. The model for moving forward is absolutely a cost shared. I think the value that the forest sector, energy sector, and the government sees in the program is significant. So we still continue to be very optimistic in moving forward and looking for the final funding arrangements as a cost-shared program coming from all of the major land managers and land resource users in the province.
But you did take quite a hit during this economic downturn. What has it done to your program?
Well, we are very much have a provincial vision. In early 2009, we were asked to scale back our operations to the tune of $2.1 million. So we've had to adjust our operations, and we made some pretty tough decisions about being able to provide relevant information at appropriate scales. Now, all of that's a lot of talk to mean that we are actually operating very aggressively in two regions of Alberta. They are aligned very closely to the new land use framework regions. The seven regions in Alberta, the first two regions to have planning developed for them are the Lower Athabasca Planning Region in northeastern Alberta and the South Saskatchewan Planning Region in the far south of Alberta from Calgary South. So we've redeployed our resources so that we're monitoring very aggressively in both of those two regions, but that does leave us with less resources to no resources operating in the rest of the province.
Well, how does the program actually run? I'm looking at a map on the wall that has a grid of spots all the way across Alberta. Could you explain to me how it would work if you were working at full capacity?
There's 1,656 spots on the ground. Those spots on the ground are, I mean, we really do randomly go to a site every 20 kilometers or about 20 kilometers. The sites represent Alberta. So some of the sites are in downtown Calgary. Some of them are in downtown Edmonton. 30% of all of our sites are on private land. So we actually have to speak with ranchers and landowners, acreage owners, and get permission to go on their site to survey biodiversity. We're operating in national parks, Department of National Defense lands, and certainly on Crown land in the province of Alberta. So they represent Alberta. They're distributed evenly across Alberta every 20 kilometers. And the idea here is that we will get back to each one of those sites every 5 years to resurvey in the same way for the same thing, so we can look at change through time and relate that to how Albertans are managing the resources out there on the land base. So again, getting back to this notion of cumulative effects assessment. How do you assess the cumulative impact of multiple land uses, whether it's recreation, energy, forestry, agriculture, getting to the heart of the cumulative impact of those kind of activities. So when we go to one site, again, there's 1,656 sites. When we go to one of those sites in a year, it's up for survey, that means that we send two people out to that site four different times in the year. We send that one crew, two people go out in the spring and they survey for birds, they look at the trees, they look at the habitat, the dead wood in the system. That same crew will come back a month later and they'll be looking at plants. They'll look at the bugs in the soil and a number of other characteristics about the site, moss, lichen, as an example. A different crew in the summer will go to a wetland that is near that one site, and they'll put a boat in the water and they'll float out there with their hip waders and take samples of the water to look at the habitat quality and the bugs that are living in the water, as well as the plants that are living on the shores of those wetland systems. And then finally, some poor unfortunate soul has to go out in January, February, or March of that year and do a survey for winter tracks. So they're looking for the mammals, moose, deer, coyotes, lynx, foxes, those kind of animals that are mammals that are active during the winter are also surveyed.
Each one of these points on the grid, how big are they?
It depends. You monitor and measure the species and the habitats at the scale that's appropriate for measuring them. So for example, when you're looking at mammals, you're interested in looking at how many moose and deer are out there on the landscape and where they're out there. You're looking at about a 9 to 10 kilometer long transect. So you walk or skidoo along a trail for 9 or 10 kilometers and count the tracks. When you're looking at springtails and mites, so these small little microscopic bugs in the soil that give you an indication of the health of the soil, you're looking at much smaller scales. So think of it as a teacup or a coffee cup kind of size hole that you would put in the ground, and you'd pull some soil out and start to extract the bugs out of that soil to look at which species are there.
These 1,600 sites, has someone been to each one of these sites in the last 10-year period?
Not all of them, so we haven't. We've got a long way to go before we finish a full rotation. We've sampled about 300. We visited about 350 of the sites, and the majority of them are kind of north of Edmonton to Fort McMurray, and then across to Grand Prairie. We have started to do quite a bit of work now in and around Calgary and south of Calgary, right down to the U.S. border, and then east-west to the Saskatchewan and B.C. borders. So we're getting quite a good sense of what kind of organisms are living in the environment and the health of those organisms across much of central Alberta and then the far south of Alberta.
So it's pretty hard to even get a baseline.
It takes a big commitment to get out there to measure each one of these sites. We've got the process for each one of these sites, I think, it's larger than we thought it was originally. You have to send two people out to one site. They do a bunch of measurements in the field, and they also take a number of samples. So if there's a plant that they don't know how to identify, or a moss or a lichen, certainly the bugs in the soil, they collect them in the field. Effectively, they put them in, you know, little bags, tag them, and then we send them back off to our partners with at the Royal Alberta Museum. So the Royal Alberta Museum plays a pretty significant role in making this happen. They have a huge shop on their end where they've got people and microscopes looking at the organisms, sifting through the material to identify the species, and then storing that information. And then they send that back to us here at the University of Alberta.
Do you try and sample absolutely everything, or are there certain species that you use as indicators?
Somewhere in between. The model that is often used, and people often think of, if we want to look at the health of our environment, people will often have a vision of, well, let's look at rare and endangered species. So if the rare and endangered species are doing well, then the rest of the environment is probably doing well. That's one assumption that happens a fair bit. That there are some flaws with that thinking. Certainly rare and endangered species are one of the most, if not the most important thing to be looking at in the environment. And there's good programs in Alberta that do look at them, but it's limited. The kind of information that you'd get back on in terms of reporting back on the healthy environment is pretty limited. The other model that you describe, which is measuring everything, is not possible. I mean, there's more than 80,000 species that we know of, and that number is probably twice as high, in living in Alberta and using our habitats as a place to live. So we have went through and made a number of choices about the kind of organisms. We want to look at more than just a few individual species, so we measure about 2,000, think about it, 2,000 to 3,000 species we collect data on. And those, the big ones at least, both physically the big ones and probably the ones that gain a fair bit of profile, are the birds, the mammals, vascular plants, moss, lichen, soil arthropods, so the bugs that live in the soil, bugs that live in the water, and then again vascular plants in water. We also have a companion monitoring program that we help to make happen, looking at the fish, so fish species as they live across the province.
You collect all these numbers, this data, but what do you do to take it and turn it into something that gives an indicator of the health of that particular area, whether it's going up or going down in terms of biodiversity?
It's a stumbling block. Nobody on the planet does this well. There are very, very few models where environmental or wildlife information is packaged in a way, analyzed in a way, communicated in a way that makes it accessible, not only to the public, but anybody who hasn't got a PhD in, you know, the environmental sciences. So many of the policymakers and managers have a tough time getting their hands around this kind of information. We spent the better part of 5 years now working with a number of scientists and a number of communication professionals on doing the analysis, so actually analyzing this information and coming up with values that we think are quite intuitive and make the information much more easy to understand.
So is this something where you could say on a scale of 1 to 10, this is the indicator?
Yeah, if you use the scale of 0 to 100, where 100 represents a pristine habitat, a wilderness area, an area with very little human footprint, and that can be anywhere in the prairies, in the parkland, foothills, or boreal forests of Alberta, and 0 represents a parking lot, right? An area where there's a gravel pit, for example, there is no biodiversity living there. So that's the kind of scale that we use. We were able to put out a report for the Lower Athabasca Planning Region. It's a preliminary report, but we released it in February of this year, indicating that the current human footprint in that entire planning region, so remember the space matters, it's a vast area right from the Northwest Territories down to Cold Lake and Lac La Biche, the current human footprint in that area is 7%, so 7% of that land base has been disturbed by human footprint, roads, energy activity, forestry activity, urban activity, and in the south, agriculture. And our data are showing that the intactness for that entire region is 94% intact today. So that's where we're at today. And then we expect to be around to monitor changes in that. And we expect that it won't remain at 94%. That as more mines come online, more energy activity comes online, I think the logical outcome of that kind of activity is that biodiversity will decline across the region.
You gather all this data. What happens to it? Where does it go?
It comes here to the University of Alberta, so I'm the director of the Information Center. There's a system here at the University of Alberta that we've been operating that manages, so all the data goes through quality control with our partners at the Alberta Research Council, collecting and managing and quality controlling the data, and as well as at the Royal Alberta Museum. They send that information here to the University of Alberta. We store and manage that data, and then it becomes publicly available on the website. So anybody with a computer can go to our site, www.abmi.ca. There's a raw data tab, and you can click onto that and sort of work your way through and start downloading all of the data that we're collecting across the province. So anybody's welcome to have the data and work with it.
How would your sponsors or energy companies, forestry companies, how would they use this? What benefit is this to them?
There's a number of benefits. I guess some of the more direct benefits are many of the organizations, the companies that are operating on Alberta's landscape, they're interested in making sure that they're operating in a way that's sustainable. So this whole program really comes down to sustainability and informed understanding about what the outcome of our activities are on Alberta's landscape.
Can you give me an example, a specific example of how the information would be used?
So for example, right now, I think the number is well over 40 now. There's 40 in-situ mines and mining operations in northeastern Alberta, so in the Athabasca oil sands deposit area. Each one of those companies is obligated under a regulatory, the Environmental Protection Enhancement Act, so there's a regulatory requirement for them to monitor the health of the environment on their specific mine site. We're starting to see that each one of those organizations is paying for contributing significant dollars to looking at the health of those sites, and they're all doing it differently. So they might monitor different things, and when they do monitor the same things, they do it in different ways. So it's good for each site. They have their own information, but the frustration is starting to come in terms of being able to ask the questions that are more relevant to Alberta. So how are moose populations doing? How are lynx populations doing? Do they remain healthy in northeastern Alberta? And what we're finding is that's a very difficult question to ask under the current system. So there's good initiative, good momentum to start using the ABMI data to answer those kind of questions. You're answering the kind of question that's relevant to Albertans at the scale that people want the answers to be happening at.
This is a program that came out of needs that were expressed in Alberta. What are people in the rest of the world doing?
There's not many examples in the rest of the world of this kind of broad-scale monitoring. There's the Scandinavian countries have a few initiatives going, particularly as it relates to the National Forest Inventory, looking at the health of the forests. They do a bit of species monitoring there as well. Switzerland certainly has a very comprehensive grid-like system that that looks a lot like Alberta's system. And the United Kingdom, through their volunteer networks, do a fantastic job of monitoring the health of many of the species that live in the UK. But other than that, there's not many examples where you can point to broad-scale monitoring and reporting that looks like ours. Certainly, I think Albertans and Alberta can be very proud that that we have this kind of program operating in our province.
Have they been looking at what Alberta's doing?
We always have good interest in what's happening from outside of our borders. As an example, we've had interest from other jurisdictions, our neighbors to the east of us in Saskatchewan, certainly further east, out in the Maritimes have shown interest in how we're going about setting up this kind of a program. And we've had good dialogue with folks in Australia as well. So they're well advanced in at least some jurisdictions at looking at these broader issues and making sure that the health of the environment is being maintained.
So I guess it comes back to money, doesn't it? Getting the money together so that you can actually do the full program. What are your plans in terms of moving forward in the future?
Well, we're going to, I think, during some fiscal belt tightening here, we're certainly going to be doing a very good job of monitoring in the two regions, the Lower Athabasca Planning Region and the South Saskatchewan Planning Region. And we continue to work to pursue funding for the rest of the program. We've been identified, we're named a number of times directly in the land use framework. The land use framework has identified that Alberta is at a tipping point today, that if we want future generations to enjoy the kind of environment that the current generation enjoys, the kind of wildlife and access to being able to go out and enjoy nature, that we're going to have to do business differently. And the ABMI has definitely been identified as a key component to making that happen and monitoring it in the future. So we're very optimistic that that in the near future, we're going to be having access to the resources that we need to operate provincially. And the notion here is that we'll probably do it incrementally as new land use planning regions come up. We'll extend our activities to make sure that we can provide that kind of information to them.
Who makes your program happen, and how do you maintain the scientific credibility?
The program is a joint cooperative initiative. It's run out of the Alberta Research Council, principally in Vegreville, the University of Alberta here in Edmonton, the Royal Alberta Museum, as well as the Alberta Conservation Association. So all four of those organizations have a hand in making sure that this program is being run effectively and efficiently. The scientific credibility is an interesting one. We have a science center. Dr. Stan Booten and Dr. Jim Sheik are both directors of that initiative, so they make sure that the scientific credibility is never compromised in the development of the program. But we felt that that wasn't enough. We trust those folks fantastically. There's 13 other researchers that work with them and around them on different aspects of our program. But we wanted an independent opinion. So in earlier this year, in 2009, March of 2009, we had our first meeting with an independent scientific committee. It's made up of world-class experts in the field of conservation biology. They fly to Edmonton, and the notion here is they'll be coming in once a year to give us independent arm's-length feedback on the quality of the science behind the program and future directions for development of the science within the program. And I'm very happy to report that they gave us a gold star. When we came in March, they certainly identified a few areas that they thought we should be working on, and we're very happy for that advice. But in the main, they thought that the program was, and confirmed our suspicion and our notion that this is a world-class program that we can be proud of.
It must be quite a job trying to take all that raw data and analyze it and turn it into something that is meaningful to people. How do you do that, and what sort of reports do you have coming out of it?
In 2009, February 2009, we released our first core report. And the information, of course, is scientifically credible. We have done a fair bit of work in trying to make that information accessible in terms of language, in terms of visual, in terms of presentation. And when we released it, we got a mixed result, which was our stakeholders, the folks that are close to the program and have sort of been with us for 10 years in development, had a lot of positive things to say and thought it was fantastic. The public, and in particular the media, sort of scratched their head a little bit, and they weren't sure what this was trying to say and how it was trying to say it. So I think we learned a lot of lessons, and we're moving forward right now with the development of a number of reports that follow on our first one. The next one will be the health of biodiversity in the Alberta Pacific Forest Industries Forest Management Area, so again in northeastern Alberta. We have plans to develop a number of other reports over the next year. The health of non-native weeds in Alberta, the health of Alberta's forests, and the health of the oil sands region in Alberta. So we'll be releasing these kind of reports, and hopefully they do nothing but improve in terms of the messaging.
With the release of this first core report, what really stands out for you, even though you can say that 94% of that region is intact in terms of biodiversity, are there some species that stand out that are either in trouble or that are doing exceptionally well?
We looked at birds and vascular plants. I mean, that was the core focus for the health of species in the Northeast. In future reports, we'll be expanding that to include mammals, moss, lichens, and invertebrates. But for this preliminary report, it was around birds and vascular plants. The main findings, and this is a bit of a surprise to me, in retrospect it shouldn't have been, but it was a bit, was that most of the signal in terms of change, our changing environment, were showing up in those species that were formerly uncommon and are now becoming much more common across the lower Athabasca planting region, so all of northeast eastern Alberta. So to name a few, the American crow, common dandelion, some of the European or non-native clovers seem to be expanding and aggressively starting to colonize the northeastern part of the province. And that was in terms of the system not being 100% intact. The majority of that that difference, that 6% deviation from intact, occurred on the shoulders of these species becoming much more common than we expected them to be. On the flip side of that, when we're talking about species declining or becoming much rarer, and the species that we looked at, the organisms that we looked at, there's no strong evidence that many of the species are declining today.
With these ones that are moving into the area, is that associated with an increased human footprint? Is that what they're associated with?
It is, yeah. Certainly there's a strong relationship to agriculture. So as agriculture moves into a region, many of the non-native species will start to move in. And then a strong association with urbanization in the center part of that region and the energy activity, the road infrastructure, linear infrastructure that happens, that sort of makes great habitat for many of these species to come in, colonize, and start to expand their ranges and territories.
In going to these different points on the grid, have you discovered any new species?
Many people think that the only place in the world where new species are discovered are in the tropics, so these very remote areas of the world. And that's just not true. So we are finding, through some of our work with our partners at the Royal Alberta Museum, we are analyzing the soil samples that we bring back and looking for, think of them as spiders in the soil. They're actually mites. They're small little critters that play a very important role in making sure that our soils remain vital and are able to grow crops that we appreciate, the trees that we appreciate. So these tiny little mites, smaller than the size of the head of a pin, we're finding many, many new species to the world are found here, right here in Alberta, just by looking. So we're very proud to report that I think there's well over 100 new species to Canada that we've identified, and well over 30 new species to the world. So no other researcher has found these species anywhere else in the world.
What do these little mites do in the soil?
It varies. It really depends. Some of them are like the grizzly bears of the soil world. So they go around and they're predators. Many of them are frugivores, so many of them eat fungus, mushrooms. They find little mushrooms and they eat that. And then there's a number of other species that live in the soil that are that break down the soil organic matter and make sure that it's being turned over and that the nutrients are available for plants to use when they're growing in the next season.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Oh, thank you.